Fargo. Roosevelt arrived at Bismarck, North Dakota, toward sunset on 7 April, and saw, opening out beyond the Missouri, the windswept landscape of his youth. Great balls of thistle spooled across the prairie. He gazed around him, visibly relaxing. Good to breathe this free western air again. He ate a barbecued ox sandwich and drank a mug of cider, then returned to his train. Two of his old Badlands buddies, Sylvain and Joe Ferris, were waiting on the other side of the water at Mandan. They climbed aboard the Elysian, their faces solemn with excitement. For the next 2 hours, Roosevelt entertained them as the flat grassland swayed in his windows. He effortlessly recalled places and scenes, even the names of horses and dogs they had forgotten. At Dickinson, he manifested himself as a sort of deus ex machina to people who remembered him as a reedy young ranchman running along the tops of cattle cars and jabbing at steers with a pole. When the train drew near the Badlands, darkness already had descended. The president went on to his rear platform and watched coolies etch themselves into the grasslands, black out of silver, like a giant printer's block. Medora lay in the deepest cut of all, a clutch of houses by the sand-choked Little Missouri. Here, 20 years before, he had come to shoot his first buffalo, and found himself, at heart, as much a westerner as an easterner. But this time he did not have to drag his duffel bag alone across the sage, and the entire population of the Badlands, as far as he could see, had gathered to welcome him. Joe Ferris was upset that Roosevelt would not take his old pony, Manitou, for a gallop through the buttes. Security forbade it. The president stayed in Medora no longer than it took to say a few words, shake every hand, and endure some fond, erroneous reminiscences. Then he was on his way again, leaving the disappointed populace to cheer itself up with a dance. Why had he looked so stern? Why had he not stayed the night? Perhaps he sought to protect some dreamy nostalgia from present scrutiny. The free range of 20 years before was gone. He did not have to dwell on its eroded green and barbed wire entanglements, nor need he ever return. Night shrouded the Chateau de Morris, home of his long-dead ranching rival, shrouded the ruins of his log house in the Elkhorn Bottom, shrouded Nolan's Hotel in Weibo, Montana, where he had once knocked out the drunken bully who had called him Four Eyes. The train sped across Montana, hauling him away from what he still thought of as Dakota, no north and south then. It was still the Wild West in those days, the Far West. It was a land of vast silent spaces, of lonely rivers, and of plains where the wild game stared at the passing horsemen. It was a land of scattered ranches, of herds of long-horned cattle, and reckless riders, who, unmoved, looked in the eyes of life or of death. In that land we lived a free and hardy life, with horse and with rifle. We worked under the scorching midsummer sun, when the wide plains shimmered and wavered in the heat, and we knew the freezing misery of riding night guard round the cattle in the late fall roundup. In the soft springtime, the stars were glorious in our eyes, each night before we fell asleep, and in the winter we rode through blinding blizzards, when the driven snow dust burnt our faces. We knew toil and hardship and hunger and thirst, and we saw men die violent deaths as they worked among the horses and cattle, or fought in evil feuds with one another. But we felt the beat of hardy life in our veins, and ours was the glory of work and the joy of living. Shortly after noon, on 8 April, Roosevelt found himself in Gardner, Montana, at the entrance to Yellowstone Canyon. The park was not yet open for the season. 10-foot drifts of snow glared in the Rockies. He looked forward to spending 2 therapeutic weeks here before continuing with his tour. When he emerged from his car, he was already wearing full riding gear and a western hat. He was followed by a short, white-bearded, instantly recognizable figure, the wildlife writer John Burroughs, revered by millions of Americans for his sentimental essays on nature. Affable, placid, and malleable, John had been invited along as a walking advertisement that the president would kill no animals in Yellowstone. They were greeted by the park superintendent, Major John Pitcher, a small escort of cavalrymen, and some mule carts loaded with camping equipment. Roosevelt swung joyfully up onto a waiting gray stallion, while Burroughs, who had not ridden a horse in 40 years, was helped into one of the carts. "By the way, Mr. President," Pitcher said as they rode through the gates, "an old friend of yours named Bill Jones has been very anxious to see you, but I am sorry to say that he has got so drunk that we had to take him out into the sagebrush." Hell-roaring Bill Jones, he of the happy triggers, the alkali thirst, and the transcendental cussing. "I will try to have him meet you before we leave the park," Pitcher promised. A guide led the way down the canyon, and Roosevelt passed out of sight. Reporters, forbidden to follow, were left hanging round the sidelined train, wondering what stories they could file for the next 15 days. A few hours after the president disappeared, flash news reached Gardner. 4 judges of the United States 8th Court in St. Louis had just upheld Roosevelt's suit against the Northern Securities Company. The opinion came as a shock to most Americans after more than a year of languid legal proceedings. It showed how the new Expedition Act had strengthened antitrust law. The court had ruled unanimously, in an astonishingly narrow interpretation of the Sherman Act, that mere power of a combination to restrain trade was earnest of intent, whether or not the power was exercised by its holding company. "If this decision is upheld by the Supreme Court," James J. Hill was quoted as saying, "no less than 85% of the railroad systems of the United States will be up in the air." William Loeb asked a soldier to hurry word of the court's ruling along the president's trail. No reply came back from the silent mountains. The Northern Securities opinion was Roosevelt's 4th political victory in fewer than 4 weeks. He had also succeeded in winning reciprocity for Cuba, digging rights in Panama, and an equitable arbitration award for last winter's striking miners. Their wages had, as expected, been raised 10% by the Anthracite Coal Commission. All these decisions, except the commission's, were subject to review. The Cuban Treaty by the House of Representatives, the Panama Canal Treaty by the Colombian Senate, and the Circuit Court ruling by the Supreme Court. But America's perennial flux and reflux of power from the executive branch to the legislative and back again seemed to have turned in his favor. That did not mean it was anywhere near a full resurgence. His unpopularity on Capitol Hill and Wall Street, as a chief executive prone to rash impulses, self-advertisement, and fiscal irresponsibility, was extreme. Remarkably, though, the nation at large, outside the white South, regarded him quite differently, as political observers were everywhere conceding, not without bemusement. One of the most articulate attempts to explain this dichotomy of opinion was that of Henry Hertzberg, a New Yorker writing for the Charleston News. He ascribed the paradox to Roosevelt's own psychology of inconsistency, illogically reflecting both an aristocratic will and a democratic desire to please. Hence, the president was both coordinated and conflicted, inimitable yet representative of a wide range of new, hard-to-define trends. Such a bosom of necessity must surge with overleaping ambition. There are passions ever impelling some righteous action, and promptings which ever restrain these moral impulses. Mr. Roosevelt is bold and fearless, yet timid and wary. He is ambitious and striving, but circumspect and cautious. He is imperious in mind, but thoughtful and considerate in action. Whether or not these temperamental traits of Mr. Roosevelt give us a picture of the typical president of the future is doubtful, but certain it is that the nervous energy, the irrepressible ambition, the fascinating elements which predominate in Mr. Roosevelt's nature represent the American character now in the making. Roosevelt was no stranger to Yellowstone, having first visited it in 1886. As founder of the Boone and Crockett Club, he had worked to save it from vandalism and exploitation, and he took pride in having been a motive force behind the National Park Protective Act of 1894. Only last year he had won an appropriation that made the Yellowstone bison wards of the federal government. Now he could enjoy the benefits of his work in solitude. Or near solitude. John Burroughs caught cold the first day and remained behind at Mammoth Hot Springs, but Major Pitcher stuck tight. Roosevelt bided his time. He passed several sociable nights with the superintendent, eating sardines and hardtack round the campfire, and helping wash up in the icy river. Each day he rode deeper into the park, while snow dust boiled in the peaks and mountain sheep stared down at him, half veiled by their own breath. He feasted his eyes, long starved for the sight of game, on pronghorns and buffalo and black-tailed deer. A giant herd of elk enthralled him for 4 hours. His ear caught the counterpoint between a solitaire singing at the top of a canyon and a water ouzel perched 1,000 feet below. On 12 April, he suddenly said that, as it was Sunday, he wished to take a walk alone. Pitcher felt unable to deny a president's desire for private devotion, so Roosevelt marched happily off and for 6 hours worshipped God in his own fashion. There were rumors later on of rifle shots echoing in the park, and Roosevelt was definitely seen with a cartridge bruise on his cheek, but Pitcher announced that the president had merely indulged in a little target shooting back at camp and been wounded by an ejected shell. Burroughs, who had rejoined the party, confirmed this. Roosevelt was sincere in his vow not to kill local wildlife, even such permissible prey as coyotes and cougar. He still lusted, or thought that he lusted, after big game, but nowadays it was the pursuit, rather than the quarry, that interested him. A new protective sensibility was notable in his account of these days in Yellowstone. Every man who appreciates the majesty and beauty of the wilderness and of wildlife should strike hands with the far-sighted men who wish to preserve our material resources in the effort to keep our forests and our game beasts, game birds and game fish, indeed all the living creatures of prairie and woodland and seashore, from wanton destruction. Above all, we should recognize that the effort toward this end is essentially a democratic movement. It is entirely within our power as a nation to preserve large tracts of wilderness, which are valueless for agricultural purposes and unfit for settlement, as playgrounds for rich and poor alike. But this end can only be achieved by wise laws and by a resolute enforcement of the laws. Roosevelt expressed contempt for the kind of game butcher who leaves deer and ducks and prairie chickens to rot. Worse still, market hunters and rich dilettantes who hunted by proxy. Only once did he weaken, when a 4-inch meadow mouse hopped across his path. He slew it in the interest of science and sent the skin and skull, with tabulations, to the United States Biological Survey. Back in Gardner, bored members of the White House Presbytale fished, scavenged for elk antlers, and got drunk with mountain men. Their third-hand reports of Roosevelt's activities began to sound slightly testy. When word came that the president had watched Old Faithful erupting and its mist turning to hail as it fell, the New York World man called it his only rival in intermittent but continuous spouting. Finally, on 24 April, a cloud of dust in the foothills signaled the president's return. The train was shunted out of its siding, and hell-roaring Bill Jones brought in from the sagebrush, stark sober for the first time in years, for a quick reunion. Before leaving, Roosevelt dedicated a new arched gateway to the park, calling Yellowstone a veritable wonderland, and noted that Europeans seemed more interested in visiting it than were most Americans. He spoke feelingly about forest reserves, buffalo breeding, and Yellowstone's essential democracy. Then, with a flash of his teeth, his face dark tan with snowburn, his nose peeling, he swung aboard the Elysian and was gone. The train moved northeast, then southeast, descending to levels of hotter, thicker air. On the flatland, it accelerated to maximum speed, crossing the Wyoming, South Dakota, and Nebraska state lines in a single day. The succession of prairie hamlets blurred into a dreary pattern to travelers on board. Always a long, low depot, red-painted and sand-coated, with wide, rakish eaves. Always a concentration of buggies and carts, iron filings magnetized on the paper-sheet plane. Roosevelt running out onto his platform and waving, sometimes with his table napkin. Those children wanted to see the President of the United States, and I could not disappoint them. Then the cheers suddenly stifled, as if a door had been slammed, and in dwindling retrospect, the sight of families turning their backs against whorls of white dust. At whistle stops, always the local dignitaries, with their furrowed eyes and crooked medals and drooping trousers, silver cornets playing Hail to the Chief, whiskery veterans of the Grand Army of the Republic, a bobbing sea of bowlers and bonnets, and invariably boys on telegraph poles, screeching, "How are you, Teddy?" Just as invariably, the President would rehearse his litany of McGuffey reader virtues. If I might have a word of advice to Omaha. Until reporters no longer bothered to transcribe them. Only Roosevelt found new stimulation 8 or 10 times a day, thundering every platitude with the pleased air of having just discovered it. He was quite unapologetic. Platitudes and iteration are necessary in order to hammer the truths and principles I advocate into people's heads. Indistinguishable as the whistle stops soon became, even to him, each was supreme drama to a little audience that had been looking forward to it for weeks. Some buggy travelers had come 100 miles to perch on the platform and peer endlessly at the horizon, waiting for a smudge of smoke to signal that Teddy was imminent. Then a speck growing in the smoke, a crescendo of wind and wheels, a great locomotive advancing, too fast, surely, to stop. Despair, as it indeed keeps moving, relief when it halts, after all, under the water tank, 100 yards down the track, a general stampede toward the Elysian, where Roosevelt stands grinning in frock coat and vest. He leans over the rail, pumping hands and tousling cowlicks. Delighted. Rearing back, he begins to orate, punctuating every sentence with palm smacks and dental percussion, while his listeners stand mesmerized. The engine bell rings, the train jerks forward. Another grin and a farewell wave. The Cheshire Cat flash of those teeth floats in the sky long after the train is a speck again. The essential democracy of Yellowstone, its lesson that government can both serve and conserve, and that future generations had as much right to natural resources as contemporaries, remained on Roosevelt's mind as he journeyed through America's heartland. The essential democracy of Yellowstone, its lesson that government can both serve and conserve, and that future generations had as much right to natural resources as contemporaries, remained on Roosevelt's mind as he journeyed through America's heartland. No longer was he the patrician politician addressing high affairs of state in eastern cities. He was, at least for the moment, a man of the earth, a cuddler of babies. Wherever he went, infants were brandished at him, wiggling representatives of the next generation. His robust views on childbearing, 3 cheers for Mr. and Mrs. Bauer and their really satisfactory American family of 12 children, were bolstered by spaces so wide and soil so deeply fertile. With the irrigation schemes he had signed into law, these plains might one day support 100 million people. In Iowa's fecund fields, glistening with spring rain, women in faded Mother Hubbard gowns crowded around his car, their arms bursting with progeny. A platoon of boys and girls hoisted a banner over their heads. "No race suicide here, Teddy." It was another of Roosevelt's catchphrases, broadly biological rather than ethnic in its implications. Bachelors declining to marry, urban women repressing their natural reproductive function, denied America the seed she needed to grow and be great. Ripeness was all. "I congratulate you upon your crops," he said, smiling around at clustered families. "But the best crop is the crop of children." Some of his new democracy, and all of his charm, was evident in the West Kansas cow town of Sharon Springs, where on 3 May he attended divine service. There were two very nice little girls standing in the aisle beside me. I invited them in, and we all three sang out of the same hymn book. They were in their Sunday best, and their brown, sunburned little arms and faces had been scrubbed till they almost shone. It was a very kindly, homely, country congregation, all of them looking well-to-do and prosperous in a way hardly warranted, as it seemed to me, by the eaten-off, wired, fence-enclosed, short-grass ranges of the dry plains roundabout. When church was over, I shook hands with the three preachers and all the congregation, whose buggies, ranch wagons, and dispirited-looking saddle ponies were tied to everything available in the village. I got a ride myself in the afternoon, and on returning found that all the population that had not left had gathered solemnly around the train. Among the rest there was a little girl who asked me if I would like a baby badger, which she said her brother Josiah had just caught. I said I would, and an hour or two later the badger turned up from the little girl's father's ranch, some 3 miles out of town. The little girl had several other little girls with her, all in clean, starched Sunday clothes and ribbon-tied pigtails. One of them was the sheriff's daughter, and I saw her nudging the sheriff, trying to get him to make some request, which he refused. So I asked what it was, and found that the 7 little girls were exceedingly anxious to see the inside of my car, and accordingly I took them all in. The interior arrangements struck them as being literally palatial, magnificent. I liked the little girls so much that I regretted having nothing to give them but flowers, and they reciprocated my liking with warm Western enthusiasm, for they hung about the car until it grew dark, either waving their hands to me or kissing their hands to me whenever I appeared at the window. The baby badger, which reminded Roosevelt of a small mattress with a leg at each corner, was christened Josiah and given well-ventilated accommodations on the Elysian's front platform. From this vantage point he was able to survey an unrolling landscape as the train proceeded to Denver and then bent south along the line of the Rockies. New Mexico territory opened up ahead, and Roosevelt began to encounter a wilder species of western fauna, Rough Rider veterans. Importunate, noisy, and side-armed, they demanded preferential access to their colonel, even in small desert towns, at 3 in the morning. First voice, "Why don't the son of a gun come out?" Bang, 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 bang. Second voice, "3 cheers for President Roosevelt." Bang, bang, bang. At Santa Fe, he was corralled by his former Mexican-American sergeant into serving as godfather at the baptism of Theodore Roosevelt Armijo in an old adobe church. Candle in hand, looking at the back of the father's swarthy neck, he reflected that his ancestors and mine had doubtless fought in the Netherlands in the days of Alva and Parma, just about the time this mission was built and before a Dutch or English colonist had set foot on American soil. In the plaza afterward, Roosevelt spoke seriously on his new theme, the conservation of natural resources. "This is a great grazing state. Because of the importance of the grazing industry, I wish to bespeak your support for the preservation in proper shape of the forest reserves of the state." He was conscious of opposition in his audience, many of whom were sheep farmers, and guiltily aware that their flocks destroyed forest growth. He tried to make them understand that forest pasturage, properly restricted and supplemented by irrigation schemes, could be self-renewing. They stood quietly in the hot square, cowboys in pale sombreros, muscular Mexican women in lace tea gowns, bandy-legged soldiers in khaki, priests in black and red cloaks, plump, prosperous-looking shepherds, and stockmen, frowning at his words. A similar audience awaited Roosevelt on the edge of the Grand Canyon. The stupendous chasm, which he had not seen before, powerfully affected him. "I don't exactly know what words to use in describing it. It is beautiful and terrible and unearthly." He was relieved to hear that the Santa Fe Railroad had rejected a plan to build a hotel at Rose Point. "Leave it as it is," he implored the crowd. "You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. Keep it for your children, your children's children, and for all who come after you." Those last words were to become a recurrent theme in Roosevelt's speeches as he crossed the Sierras and descended the Pacific slope. All the landscape was new to him now. He exulted in California's lush, feminine fertility. Here, literally blossoming around him, was desert-made flowerland by irrigation. Houses embowered with roses and grapevines, deep orchards, acres of golden poppies, wildflowers speckling the sage in pointillistic patterns. Here, he told himself, a new type of American child was growing up, indigenous as the flowers, half familiar yet exotic. New York seemed impossibly far away, Europe a historical memory. I felt as if I was seeing Provence in the making, that is, Provence changed by, and in its turn changing, a northern race. 1,500 children and millions of flowers greeted him at Redlands on 7 May. The roadway under his carriage was so thick with rose petals that he rolled along soundlessly and fragrantly. When he arrived in front of the Casa Loma Hotel, the children serenaded him. They pelted him with blossoms as he stood up to speak. Again he talked of irrigation, of conservation, and of procreation. There were yet more children and roses at San Bernardino and Riverside and Pasadena. Their upthrust arms, holding bouquets, seemed to undulate in the breeze of his rhetoric. Roosevelt became slightly incoherent, as if drunk on the scented air. "This plain tilled by the hand of man, as you have never tilled it, until it blossomed like the rose, blossomed as I never dreamed in my life that the rose could blossom." But the horticultural climax to his visit was yet to come. He reached Los Angeles on 8 May, in time for the final parade of the Fiesta de Flores. Looking dazed, he sat on the reviewing stand as marshals rode by, perched on saddle blankets apparently woven from carnations and roses. They were followed by a barren float piled with sand and bones, the desert as cadaver, unlamented. Then came a tableau of efflorescent California, waterworks spraying mist over seedlings and grain, harsh sunflowers yielding to lilies and pansies, citrus and olive groves jiggling with fruit. The floats, drawn by ropes and chains of flowers, became ever more extravagant. A 30-foot mobile garden, courtesy of the Los Angeles Parks Department, an 8-foot pyramid of white carnations, symbolizing the purity of organized labor, a submarine of scarlet geraniums, and a flower globe of the earth, with the United States picked out in yellow daisies between oceans of undulating fern. Amid all the color and luxuriance, nubile girls in white waved prettily to the president's obvious pleasure. For 4 hours, the child California bloomed like a rose before him. The sight of an enormous redwood towering above Santa Cruz 3 days later was expected also to enchant the president, but he frowned at its petticoat of calling cards and advertising posters. "Those cards pinned up on that tree give an air of the ridiculous to this majestic grove," he said angrily. He began to lecture bystanders. "Do keep these trees, keep all the wonderful scenery of this wonderful state, unmarred by vandalism or the folly of man." Refusing an official escort, he went to cool off in a nearby grove. When he came back, the cards had been taken down. "There is nothing more practical in the end than the preservation of beauty," Roosevelt declared the next day. He was speaking at Stanford University, whose architecture and setting, half Pacific, half Mediterranean, enhanced his impression of California as the loveliest of states. In a major conservation address, he urged the students to respect their natural heritage. "I feel most emphatically that we should not turn into shingles, a tree which was old when the first Egyptian conqueror penetrated to the valley of the Euphrates." This was not to say that most of the North American forest could not be used, scientifically and efficiently, if government exerted its just powers. Properly protected, woodlands and grasslands would function forever as sponge-like sources of water for irrigation, making immense tracts of arable land available to homesteaders under the National Reclamation Program. Water speculation, rentals charged by the private owners of dams and streams in semi-desert areas, would dwindle as public reservoirs swelled. Monopoly, whether of wood or water, would be confounded, and land laws refined to their original democratic purpose. We have a right to expect that the best trained, the best educated men on the Pacific Slope, the Rocky Mountains, and Great Plains states will take the lead in the preservation and right use of the forests, Roosevelt roared. He did not add that he had quietly expanded the federal woodland by one-third in his first year as president. Such a boast would only antagonize Western reactionaries. Concern mounted, meanwhile, behind boardroom doors on Wall Street, that Theodore Roosevelt was an extremely dangerous man. For all his lip service at Milwaukee and St. Paul to laissez-faire ways, he seemed to stand, in the eyes of Henry W. Taft, for a pretty pronounced type of socialism. He had shown prejudice against railroad owners, beef packers, and coal mine operators. He had won a referral of Knox's Northern Securities suit to the Supreme Court and stirred up hell in the South. Now he was protecting foliage and threatening to strengthen the public land laws. His professed truce with the trusts was likely to last as long as it took him to win the presidency in his own right. Once he got the executive bit between those grinning, biting teeth, there would be no holding him. A group of financiers asked whom they would prefer to see as the Republican nominee in 1904, replied almost unanimously, "Somebody like Hanna." More than 2,500 miles, and a greater distance between prejudice and perception, prevented Roosevelt's capitalist critics from seeing him address a conservative audience of citizens of the Golden State at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco on 12 May. Had they done so, they might have been reassured as to his physical soundness. Standing in white tie over a table spread with cloth of gold, beneath hanging golden garlands 2 feet thick, he accepted a gold-loving cup and reverently invoked the need for a gold basis for the nation's currency. His subsequent call for a more elastic money supply could have been written by Senator Aldrich, and indeed probably was. The next morning at Mechanics Pavilion, Roosevelt changed guises, reverting to the exultant imperialism of his pre-presidential days. He looked toward the Orient and saw nothing but an American ocean, veined with American cables and crisscrossed by American freighters, the largest in the world. "Before I came to the Pacific Slope, I was an expansionist." Applause. "And after having been here, I fail to understand how any man, convinced of his country's greatness, can be anything but an expansionist." Applause. "In the century that is opening, the commerce and the command of the Pacific will be factors of incalculable moment in the world's history." He reviewed the rise and fall of seagoing civilizations from the Phoenicians and Carthaginians to the more recent navies and merchant marines of northern conquerors. California, America's new Greece, must now rise to the commercial and cultural challenges of the greatest of all the seas. The United States as a whole must follow its westward destiny until West and East merged. This meant a new global strategy. In the South Seas, the great Commonwealth of Australia has sprung into being. Japan, shaking off the lethargy of centuries, has taken her rank among civilized, modern powers. European nations have seated themselves along the eastern coast of Asia, while China, by her misfortunes, has given us an object lesson in the utter folly of attempting to exist as a nation at all, if both rich and defenseless. The audience understood Roosevelt's last reference very well. He was bringing his historical survey right up to date. Current newspapers agitatedly reported a crisis situation in the Chinese province of Manchuria. Tsar Nicholas II, whose forces had occupied that industrialized region for 5 years, had failed to honor a promised withdrawal timetable. Now Russian officials were conspiring to keep Manchurian ports closed to foreign trade, a clear breach of Secretary Hayes' open-door policy in the Far East, while profiting themselves from mining and shipping concessions. And much to Japanese alarm, the Trans-Siberian Railway, with its seemingly limitless capability to bring in military reinforcements, was nearing completion. In other disturbing Russian news, dispatches reported a mass killing of Jews in the Bessarabian city of Kishinev. Casualty figures, worse than the censor will permit to publish, were leaking out. The American Hebrews estimate was 120 killed and 500 injured in anti-Semitic riots. The Tsar himself was rumored to have ordered the slaughter. For the first time, popular unease was palpable about the ever-burgeoning empire in the East. It loomed beyond the haze of the Pacific horizon, menacing primarily Japan. American hearts warmed to that warlike little power, if only because it stood as a bulwark for the Philippines. Roosevelt was constrained, as president, from criticizing the domestic policies of another sovereign state, but he made clear that he would not tolerate Russian aggression in the Pacific. The inevitable march of events gave us the control of the Philippine Islands at a time so opportune that it may, without irreverence, be called providential, he said. Unless we show ourselves weak, unless we show ourselves degenerate sons of the sires from whose loins we sprang, we must go on with the work we have undertaken. Applause interrupted him. We infinitely desire peace, and the surest way of obtaining it is to show that we are not afraid of war. After making his standard calls for muscular morality at home and a big navy abroad, he concluded on a note of exaltation, rare even for him. Our place as a nation is and must be with the nations that have left indelibly their impress on the centuries. Those that did not expand passed away, and left not so much as a memory behind them. The Roman expanded, the Roman passed away, but the Roman has left the print of his law, of his language, of his masterful ability in administration, deep in the world's history, deeply imprinted in the character of the races that came after him. I ask that this people rise level to the greatness of its opportunities. 2 evenings later, Roosevelt lay high in Yosemite on a bed of fragrant pine needles, looking up at the sky. On all sides soared the cinnamon-colored shafts of sequoia trees. He had the feeling that he was lying in a great solemn cathedral, far vaster and more beautiful than any built by the hands of man. Birdsong filled the arches as the sky darkened. He identified the treble tessitura of hermit thrushes and thought it an appropriate choir for such a place of worship. His companion was John Muir, the glaciologist, naturalist, and founder of the Sierra Club. Since early youth, Muir had roamed Yosemite, carrying little more than some bread and tea in an old sock, returning to civilization as infrequently as possible. At 65, he knew more about the park and loved it more passionately than any other American. Roosevelt had booked his exclusive services well in advance. I want to drop politics absolutely for 4 days and just be out in the open with you. The president was disappointed to find that Muir had no ear for bird music. He was Wordsworthian rather than Keatsian, revering only rocks and stones and trees. Garrulous, erudite, and wall-eyed, he talked a pure form of preservation that Roosevelt was not used to hearing. He had no patience with the utilitarian greatest good for the greatest number policy of Chief Forester Gifford Pinchot, the president's very good friend. Conservation favored business at the expense of nature, and property rather than beauty. The greatest number is too often found to be number one. Whatever resonance such views found in the president's own developing awareness of the democracy of national parks, he would have preferred to hear less of Muir and more of the hermit thrushes. Eventually, he fell asleep in the piney air. Another bird corral saluted him at dawn. For the next 48 hours, the boy in Roosevelt, never quite suppressed, reveled in his wild surroundings. "This is bully," he yelled, when Muir burned a dead tree for him and the sparks hurtled skyward. After another night out, he awoke at Glacier Point and was intrigued to find himself buried under 4 inches of snow. "This is bullier." On 17 May, he came down from the peaks in dusty khakis, his eyes sparkling. "I never felt better in my life." Muir, too, was elated, having confessedly fallen in love with the president's interesting, hardy, and manly personality. The substance of their camping conversations remained tacit, suggesting some philosophical difference on the subject of Gifford Pinchot. Muir won at least an immediate presidential order to extend the California forest through the Mount Shasta region, and a promise that Yosemite's over-commercialized valley would be ceded back to the national park system. Roosevelt's next conservation statement, on 19 May, was obstinately utilitarian, yet an eloquent plea later that day echoed the preservationist sentiments he had expressed at the Grand Canyon. Speaking in Sacramento, he begged Californians to preserve their marvelous natural resources, unimpaired. "We are not building this country of ours for a day. It is to last through the ages." On the morning of 23 May, Roosevelt sailed across Puget Sound toward Seattle, the apogee of his great swing across the nation. "Well, thank heaven," he wrote Henry Cabot Lodge, "tomorrow I turn my face toward the east." He suddenly, with a returning traveler's sense of anticlimax, felt as spent as the fireworks fizzling in the sun over Alki Point. "I am so jaded and nerve-weary and bored that it almost seems as if I could not go through the remainder of the speech-making." Seattle neither knew nor cared about the president's tiredness. From the moment he stepped ashore, inexorable hands nudged him from platform to platform, and 50,000 worshippers drained him with their adoration. It was late at night before he fell into bed at the Hotel Washington, only to be shaken awake by William Loeb. He had forgotten to address a banquet group downstairs. He must get up, don full evening dress, step out on the balcony, apologize, and say a few words. When he retired for the second time, Roosevelt had to struggle with a problem new to him, insomnia. Fortunately for his rest, a telegram dispatched that afternoon from Cleveland did not reach him until the next morning. "The issue which has been forced on me, in the matter of our state convention this year endorsing you for the Republican nomination next year, has come in a way which makes it necessary for me to oppose such a resolution. When you know all the facts, I am sure you will approve my course. M.A. Hanna." Roosevelt, fatigue forgotten, pondered this telegram excitedly as his train wound east to Walla Walla. He felt in the mood for a knockdown and drag-out fight with Hanna and the whole Wall Street crowd. Fate had placed a big political stick in his hands. Fate, or Joseph B. Foraker, Ohio's wily, irascible senior senator, had for years been plotting to wrest control of the state Republican Party from Hanna. That organization was about to have its annual convention, and Foraker had issued a surprise demand that the state party endorse Theodore Roosevelt for president 1 year early. This put Hanna in the impossible position of having to deny the resolution without seeming to be against the president's nomination. Alternatively, if he confirmed it, he would seem to be engineering an endorsement for himself. Either way, he stood to lose presidential favor, while Foraker would gain power and prestige, and a possible chance at the GOP nomination in 1908. Roosevelt saw an irresistible chance to play one senator off the other. Hanna was clearly appealing for help. He was not in good health, if Wall Street was not so determined to have somebody like Hanna in the White House. He would surely have disclaimed any presidential ambition whatsoever. Roosevelt dictated a curtly formal reply and released it to the press at Walla Walla. "Your telegram received. I have not asked any man for his support. I have had nothing whatever to do with raising the issue. Inasmuch as it has been raised, of course, those who favor my administration and my nomination will favor endorsing both, and those who do not will oppose. Theodore Roosevelt." Hanna had no choice but to wire back that, in view of the sentiment expressed, he would not, after all, oppose the resolution. Thus the President added a 15th endorsement to the list of states already committed to him, forced neutrality upon Hanna, gratified Foraker, and banished his own nerve-weariness. Benison-like, the lilacs and locusts of Walla Walla enveloped him in their fragrance. "This whole incident," he wrote to Lodge, "has entirely revived me." Roosevelt arrived at Butte, Montana, on 27 May, to find that mining city divided, like the Ohio GOP, into two warring political factions. Neither bore much relation to national party lines, and both were eager to welcome him. He saw at once that the crowd was filled with whooping enthusiasm and every kind of whiskey, and that a riot might ensue if either camp felt slighted. Modeling his conduct on that of Mr. Pickwick at Eatonsville, he presented an equable face to both Buffs and Blues, addressing the former in the afternoon and the latter in the evening. He solved the problem of apportioning dinner tickets by asking Butte's enormous top-hatted mayor to issue exactly 100 seats on a 50-50 basis. Satisfied, the factions respectively presented him with a silvered copper vase and a silver loving cup. Roosevelt was touched by a third gift, a pair of silver scales, from Butte's black minority. "This," he said, lifting it delicately aloft, "comes in the shape I appreciate, the scales of justice held even." He waited until the applause died. "I fought beside the colored troops at Santiago, and I hold that if a man is good enough to be put up and shot at, then he is good enough..." Again he paused while the crowd held its breath, wondering whether he was going to risk violence with a racially charged remark. Scattered Negroes, some Swedes, two Austrian families, a Chinese, and an Australian, jostled with polyglot miners, rough riders, and dangerous-looking rednecks from the Coeur d'Alene. Roosevelt's old friend, Seth Bullock, of Deadwood, South Dakota, stood guard with a long 44. "For me to do what I can to get him a square deal," said the President. The phrase sank in, and the crowd relaxed. "Nobody made a motion to attack me," Roosevelt wrote John Hay afterward. "My address was felt to be honor enough for one hotel, and the dinner was given in the other. When the dinner was announced, the mayor led me in, or, to speak more accurately, tucked me under one arm and lifted me partially off the ground, so I felt as if I looked like one of those limp dolls with dangling legs carried around by small children, like Mary Jane in the Gollywogs, for instance. As soon as we got in the banquet hall and sat at the head of the table, the mayor hammered lustily with the handle of his knife and announced, 'Waiter, bring on the feed.' Then, in a spirit of pure kindness, he added, 'Waiter, pull up the curtains and let the people see the President eat.' But to this I objected. The dinner was soon in full swing. Of the 100 men who were my hosts, I suppose at least half had killed their man in private war, or had striven to encompass the assassination of an enemy. They had fought one another with reckless ferocity. They had been allies and enemies in every kind of business scheme, and companions in brutal revelry. As they drank great goblets of wine, and sweat glistened on their hard, strong, crafty faces, they looked as if they had come out of the pictures in Aubrey Beardsley's Yellow Book." Roosevelt left, prudently early. He stood on the rear platform of the Elysian as his train pulled out of town, and the citizens of Butte howled and fired shots into the air. They would doubtless continue to celebrate all night. After re-canvassing Idaho, the train headed south to Salt Lake City, then east, recrossing the plains of Wyoming, Nebraska, Iowa, and Illinois. May turned to June. Day after day, freak rainstorms beat down. On either side of the tracks, the vast Midwest lay flat and flooded, halved by Roosevelt's trajectory. Here in the heartland of the country was his political center of gravity. Ahead of him in the baggage car sat his silver scales, effortlessly maintaining their balance. The Negroes of Butte had chosen well. Nothing appealed to him more than the concept of equilibrium. Justice separating good and evil. Power, my hand on the lever, regulating the conflicting interests of blacks and whites, buffs and blues, tycoons and tradesmen, the born and the unborn. The phrase he had coined en route, a square deal, was potent. He tried it again on 4 June, standing in the drizzle by Lincoln's tomb. Cheers and applause resounded in the wet air. He created one further magnificent image at Springfield Armory, as the sun lowered on the last day of his tour. Rhetorically, it was too strange, too poetic to register on his audience. He seemed hardly to notice it himself, and never used it again. But after 8 weeks of travel and 262 speeches, he could think of no more slogans, no more positive platitudes. Blinking with exhaustion, he found only a compressed negative metaphor for himself and the social forces he sought to mediate. "Envy and arrogance," said Roosevelt, "are the two opposite sides of the same black crystal." Whatever private perplexity this suggested, did he see the presidency, for all his efforts to fire it up, as something cold and dark at heart, merely reflecting outside passions? Was negated by male buffoonery that evening as the train sped across Indiana. Roosevelt was sitting in his parlor with the Hoosier State's quarrelsome senators, Charles W. Fairbanks and Albert J. Beveridge, when two reporters marched in, waggishly attired in top hats and frock coats. "Mr. President, we desire to present you the keys of our great and beautiful car. The freedom of the Gilsey is yours, sir." Roosevelt recalled that he had promised to accept the hospitality of the press on the final night of his tour. "My fellow Americans," he cried, his voice choked with fake sobs, "I am deeply affected by this spontaneous welcome, this unparalleled and unprecedented greeting." He allowed himself to be escorted forward. Fairbanks and Beveridge joined the general exodus of White House staff to the Gilsey. As Roosevelt passed through the Senegal, two grinning black porters snapped to attention, saluting him with brooms. Hideous caricatures of Teddy lined the walls. A small group of cordoned-off reporters, pretending to be a welcoming crowd, cheered and clicked Kodaks. Roosevelt shook with laughter. "Well, this is bully." He proceeded under an arch of spread trousers to his table in the Gilsey, where the menu sent him into further convulsions. It advertised "haunch of snow-fed cinnabar mountain lion" and "puree of Yosemite mule," and was footnoted, "guests who find their wine too warm will notice an improvement after placing their glasses between any two senators from the same state who happen to be present." The subsequent dinner was private, but leaks indicated that the president talked a string and ate like a farmhand. He was in bed by midnight. Ohio rumbled by, unseen in the small hours. Ahead, Pennsylvania's hills waited for dawn. Barreling through blackness, the train twisted, now left, now right. Chapter 16. White Man Black and Black Man White. "The black has many fine qualities. He is joyous, light-hearted, and easily lynched." Senator Beveridge and others getting off Roosevelt's train in Washington on 5 June 1903 were amazed to see a multitude jamming Pennsylvania Avenue all the way downtown from 6th Street Station. Normally, the Capitol paid little attention to executive comings and goings, but this looked like an almost royal welcome. Apparently, the president's forceful oratory on tour, his widely reported disappearances into the wilderness, and his haughty suppression of Mark Hanna, in Walla Walla of all places, had caught the public's imagination and strengthened him as the likely ruler of America for 6 more years. Roosevelt now enjoyed the endorsement of 16 state Republican organizations, and 17 more were expected to follow suit. "He will be nominated by acclamation," Beveridge predicted, "and elected by the greatest popular majority ever given a president." For the moment, Roosevelt was interested in the acclamation of only an intimate minority. He addressed a few words to the crowd in Lafayette Square, then rasped, "I thank you again, my friends, but now I am going in to my own folks." Edith had been busy with landscapers during his absence. The White House grounds, winter bare when he saw them last, and littered with construction rubble, were elegantly lush. The north lawn was a sheet of velvet, its beds bejeweled with pansies. Blossoms dense as ermine lay on the shrubbery. Fountains rose above the new terraces to east and west, separated by plantings of boxwoods and Dutch bays. Although the president could not see it yet, there was a surprise tennis court waiting for him just south of his office window. Perhaps Edith had read about his prodigious eating over the last 8 weeks. Ox steaks on rye in North Dakota, dozens of fried grayling at Yellowstone, lamb and white bread spread with cream in Nebraska, Pluvier au Cresson and Petit Four at St. Louis, a 2-hour chuck wagon breakfast on the Colorado prairie, T-bones and broilers at Yosemite, and always, between stops, presidential command of the Elysian's kitchen. He was aware of having gained 17 pounds en route to the Pacific. There would be inevitable comparisons with Stout Cortez, and Elihu Root was bound to ask archly for a copy of his remarks on expansionism. A younger, slimmer, oil-painted Roosevelt greeted him in the vestibule. Edith had hung Fedor Anka's portrait there, rather than the more recent rendering by John Singer Sargent, knowing that her husband loved to see himself in Rough Rider uniform. "I cannot say that I think it looks particularly like me," he commented, but admitted that it was the image he wanted his children to have of him. Roosevelt's vanity was oddly leavened with modesty. He never failed to take the bait when Root drawled, "Mr. President, I would like so much to have you give us an account of the fight at San Juan Hill." Yet he deferred to all Civil War veterans. He lectured some of the finest minds in America on their own specialties, while protesting his own intellectual ordinariness. "I am but the average man." Living in a White House more formal than any in history, he nevertheless entertained cowboys and backwoodsmen there on equal terms with cabinet officers and diplomats. Although political analysts were beginning to use the word genius to describe his political sleight of hand, he scoffed at such hyperbole. Genius was what drove Frank Jarvis in the 100 meters, or John Keats in Ode on a Grecian Urn. Power to do what no one else has the power to do. His own power, idiosyncratic as it seemed, was the same given to all presidents. Democratically won, it could be democratically lost, as soon as he failed to please. Yet his wife, watching him swig Apollinaris from his Golden State loving cup, as if he were a king of Thule, noticed a new, almost placid confidence in his attitude toward affairs of state. Less intimate observers, such as former Senator David B. Hill, feared the development of demagogical and dangerous tendencies. There was little anyone could do to restrain Roosevelt for the next half year until the new Congress was sworn in. 3 current issues offered him much opportunity for excessive rashness: Jewish demands to protest the Kishinev pogrom, allegations of spoilsmanship, forgery, bribery, and fraud in the Post Office Department, and reports that resistance to the Panama Canal Treaty had developed in Colombia. To all of these challenges, the King of Thule felt equal. He would receive the Jews, and make the post office's own internal investigation, relating fortunately to matters predating his presidency, an essay on open government. But the third matter required urgent attention. One of his first acts, on returning to his desk, was to ask the State Department for a copy of the 1902 Canal Bill, which spelled out his powers in the event of non-ratification. John Hay cautioned him that there was no immediate crisis. The Colombian Congress had not yet assembled to debate the treaty, and President José Manuel Marroquín was constitutionally authorized to override any negative vote. There was no guarantee, though, that Marroquín would so override. Roosevelt discovered that Hay had been keeping quiet about a sharp deterioration in Colombian-American relations. Cables from the American minister in Bogotá, Arthur M. Beaupré, quoted angry local protests against any surrender of sovereignty in the canal zone and described a general feeling that the treaty prescribed a loss of the national honor. Apparently, this feeling related to the $10 million fee negotiated by Hay and Iran. Beaupré said that he had received private assurances that Colombia's honor would be restored if the United States agreed to pay a much greater sum of money. Hay, a poet's soul in a diplomat's body, reacted with sulky distress to any criticism of his treaties. An instrument like this, the painstakingly worded distillation of months of gentlemanly conversation, of late-night pourparlers and next-morning memorials, calligraphed at last on crisp parchment, was as dear to him as any sonnet. Wholesale rejection was apt to aggravate his chronic depression. Roosevelt moved quickly to restore the diplomatic offensive and Hay's wilting morale. One of the most important conventions in the history of the Americas demanded a resolute State Department. He saw the secretary briefly, behind closed doors, on the afternoon of 8 June. Whatever transpired, Hay returned to work as if galvanized. The next morning, new instructions went out to Beaupré, couched in language of unusual force. The Colombian government apparently does not appreciate the gravity of the situation. The canal negotiations were initiated by Colombia and were energetically pressed upon this government for several years. The propositions presented by Colombia, with slight modifications, were finally accepted by us. In virtue of this agreement, our Congress reversed its previous judgment and decided upon the Panama route. If Colombia should now reject the treaty or unduly delay its ratification, the friendly understanding between the two countries would be so seriously compromised that action might be taken by the Congress next winter, which every friend of Colombia might regret. Hay acted like a new man in the days that followed. Town gossip had it that 21 months of strenuous Teddy had enfeebled him, that he was being kept on only as a venerable symbol, Washington's last link with the administration of President Lincoln. There was some truth to both rumors, although Hay was still capable of inspired diplomacy, and his relationship with Roosevelt was genuinely affectionate, rooted in a mutual memory of Theodore Sr., introducing them nearly 33 years before, reedy boy and young diplomat, shaking hands to the roar of the Hudson Valley thunderstorm. At 64, Hay was still as elegant as he had been then. The severe cut of his Savile Row clothes gave line to his 5-foot-2-inch figure, while a slight fullness of silk under the winged collar focused attention on his unforgettable face. In youth, when merely mustached, Hay had looked almost Mandarin, with his high cheekbones and Ming-smooth brow. Now the mustache floated over a magnificent, whitened Van Dyke, while the skin above was slashed with creases, two of the deepest plummeting in a frown so anguished that photographers felt obliged to retouch them. The secretary was, by common consent, one of the great talkers of his time, holding forth in a quiet, beautiful voice. Like a well-resined viola, it poured forth suave melodies, lapsing instantly into accompaniment whenever the presidential trumpet sounded. Even more than Root, Hay was a master of the sly mot juste, that inspired Roosevelt to go too far. His inert pose and hazel stare gave no hint of the hilarity suppressed beneath his waistcoat. Although Hay found the president amusing, he never savaged him as Adams did. He recognized that Roosevelt had plenty of brains and a heart of gold, not to mention a gift for storytelling that rivaled his own. Curious to hear about the great cross-country trip, he invited Roosevelt to dinner on 12 June, along with Ambassador and Madame Jusserand. With very little encouragement, the president launched beaming into an account of his adventures. Big sticks and badgers and midnight fusillades, rose-petaled streets and redwoods, golden gifts and glistening, Beardsley-esque faces held the table entranced. As he talked on and on, Roosevelt began to free-associate earlier Western memories of sharing a bed with the judge who jailed Calamity Joe, of hell-roaring Bill Jones chasing a lunatic across the prairie, of bandy-legged Frank Brito shooting at his wife the time he killed his sister-in-law. To Jusserand, such stories sounded as remote and strange as any in Piers Plowman. Roosevelt's extraordinary frankness, his high-pitched mirth, punctuated with table thumps and chortles of hoo-hoo, and perpetual discharge of energy, were such that the ambassador could conclude only that France was being vouchsafed some sort of privileged audience. After dinner, Hay displayed some of the rarities in his library. Roosevelt took up an autographed page proof of the Gettysburg Address, then, his mind leaping to other subjects, began to talk and gesticulate. The precious sheet flapped in the air to Hay's silent agony. Rescuing it, he begged Roosevelt to endow him with a typed transcript of his Western monologue to preserve for posterity. Roosevelt, flattered, promised to oblige. The Colombian Minister for Foreign Affairs was mystified by Hay's cable. What was this threatened action by the United States? Something directly aggressive, or just reversion to a Nicaragua canal? Beaupré did not know, and the State Department sent no clarification. 30 years of foreign policy experience had taught Hay to keep his opponents guessing. There are three species of creature, he liked to quip, who when they seem coming are going, diplomats, women, and crabs. That same day, 13 June, Roosevelt sat in private conference with William Nelson Cromwell. It was not his habit to receive